This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
Women attending college don't exactly practice the healthiest lifestyles. Now, I'm sure that comes as no big surprise. But a new study about the activity level of these students shines a new light on what can motivate a woman to start eating better and getting some exercise.
We know across the lifespan, but particularly in college, women get less physical activity on average than men. And the health behaviors you engage in during college are actually predictive of your long-term behavior.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk to the lead author of that study to see what it takes to get some college-age students moving. We'll also learn that pressure on women to be their best doesn't start in college, and we'll spend an academic minute dealing with peer pressure to chow down. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. A new study shows that less than one half of college women achieve the daily level of physical activity recommended for weight control and overall health. But the study from the University of Scranton and Drexel University shows that there is a big difference in physical activity across days, weeks, and months, though this variation is rarely measured. Dr. Danielle Arrigo is assistant professor of psychology at the University of Scranton and is the study's lead author. She found that college-age women increase their exercise from their usual levels when they're feeling bad about their bodies and after perceiving that they overeat. These relationships were independent of weight change and actual calorie intake, suggesting that self-perception is extremely important for physical activity. The Best of Our Knowledge's Allison Dunn spoke with Dr. Arrigo about her study and its potential impacts.
So this was an opportunity for me and for some collaborators to take a look at some data that had already been collected where physical activity was not the main outcome that was being looked at. But to try to, because we had so much of the data over a long period of time, to try to look in a really time-sensitive way at what was predicting physical activity, high physical activity and low physical activity for college women during the first couple of years of college, and to see, are those predictors consistent over the first couple of years of college, and is physical activity changing as those change? We're used to examining really static predictors of physical activity. So are you the kind of person who, you know, has a certain personality characteristic or has a certain level of physical activity? This really says for the same person over time, your experiences are going to change and your physical activity changes along with those experiences.
So what did you find?
So basically what we found is that at and subsequent to times when college women report that their body satisfaction is pretty low relative to their normal. So this is all relative to what's normal for you. At times when their body image was particularly negative and at times when they perceived themselves as having overeaten or being really responsive to food in their environment, those were the times when they got the most physical activity, again, relative to their normal.
So what do you do with that information? How do you incorporate it into culling a healthier lifestyle?
So there are lots of potential implications. The first is that if you take the flip side of that, so trying to understand if college women, and maybe women more generally, that's still an open question, but definitely for college women, if they're exercising in response to not liking their appearance or thinking that they've overeaten, that's going to be highly variable over time. And one of the things we know about physical activity is it's of the most benefit if you're consistent over time. So trying to get one of the primary implications is that maybe those kinds of highly variable motivations for physical activity are not the ones that we should be relying on, and really trying to better understand how to help college women invest themselves in motivations for physical activity that are more consistent. So something like, regardless of how I feel about my body or regardless of how much I've eaten, I'm going to stay consistent with my physical activity because it's important to me for these other reasons, whether that's about overall health or stress management or it helps me just feel better about myself. That's going to be much more consistent over time than something like, well, I'm going to exercise just when I don't like the way my body looks.
So why college women? And I noticed that your samples focus on urban colleges. Why not rural?
So I think what you're identifying, first of all, is all of the work that's still left to do. So part of the reason we did it the way that we did it is that, again, these were data that had already been collected from a weight gain prevention study in college women. So the one reason to focus on college women is that we know across the lifespan, but particularly in college, women get less physical activity on average than men. Women are less consistent in their physical activity than men, and college behaviors, the health behaviors you engage in during college, are actually predictive of your long-term behavior. So if you're able to solidify really good behaviors in college, and more women are going to college, more and more young people in general are going to college, if we're able to capture this group and solidify healthy behaviors during that time period, it could bode well across the lifespan. So this is something we're learning more about. There isn't a ton of data in this area, but what data we have suggests that if you look at behaviors during college and then you follow the same people 5 to 10 years later, there's a really high correlation between what they're doing in college and what they're doing afterward. So we also need to, of course, identify the people who are not, who might have good health behaviors during college, but maybe are not keeping those up over the long term, and how we can help them maintain over time. One of the things that our prevention and intervention programs are really good at is helping people change their behaviors in the short term. It's a lot harder to help people maintain those behaviors over the long term. So I think one of the benefits of the study that we did is we looked at a long period of time, and we were able to see, first of all, that physical activity does vary over 2 years, and that that variability is predicted by these inconsistent motivations. And as I mentioned, for women in particular, because they get less physical activity than men and because there's such a high risk of cardiovascular disease, particularly later in life, if women are inactive, that's really sort of the public health significance of why I think it's important to solidify these behaviors as early in life as possible.
So on whose shoulders does this fall in terms of changing the outcome? Obviously, the women involved, but it's bigger than that, right?
So I think there are lots of potential stakeholders or organizations or levels of intervention that really could be helpful. Of course, there's the individual level, that each of us has some control over our own behaviors, and that the more we can make people aware of what influences their behavior and give them the knowledge and power to change their own behaviors, that's always going to be helpful. But we're learning more and more about how the environment, without us realizing it, shapes our behavior, how social norms shape our behavior. And in those ways, college health promotion programs can be really helpful for creating a culture of health on college campuses where it is the norm and it is considered the cool and normal thing to do to engage in healthy behaviors. You mentioned looking at more rural areas, that's some follow-up work that really needs to be done. Are we seeing a trend that covers all demographics in college, or is this something that's really unique to urban areas? I think that's an open question that we need to investigate, and getting as many community resources as we possibly can, because of course we're also not able to say with certainty what's happening for people who are in this same age group who are not attending college. And those people are likely different from the ones who are participating in our studies. And so how would interventions and programs really need to be different and tailored for those groups? All of that work is being done, but we need to invest a lot of resources in trying to understand not just what happens generally, but really what does it take for this individual person? What kind of knowledge, what kind of skills, what kind of environment did they need to be successful? And what does success look like for them?
That's interesting, because I think of college, be it urban or rural, as a place where one needs to walk to class. I mean, you cannot park your car in the classroom. I mean, one needs to expend some level of energy. So I'm wondering why such a differential between men and women. Is it that men are more participatory in organized sports or even just throwing the ball around to de-stress? And excuse the stereotypical and gross generalizational nature of this, but are women more prone to sit around and talk rather than throwing that ball around?
I think there are a lot of reasons, and stereotypical or not, I think you're hitting on something that really the data would back up. But in general, for men, it's more normal to have a social event that is geared around some sort of physical activity. So whether it's throwing a ball around or joining an intramural frisbee team or just generally like going out for a walk, you know, men aren't necessarily power walking in college. but it's much more normative to hear college men talking about active events that they went to with their friends. Whereas for women, what's social about physical activity, women actually would prefer to engage in physical activity that has some sort of social component, but there isn't as much structure around that for women. So we hear a lot of women say, well, if I had someone I could go to the gym with, or if I had a class that I could take where there would be other people there who I would know, I'd be so much more comfortable than doing it by myself. So for guys, that might be the case, but they're not bringing that up as a barrier because those seem to already exist for them, or they're thinking about it a little bit differently than women are. But for women, the social component is a big barrier that we need to figure out, like, how do we catalyze this social behavior around going to the gym, around being more active when you're spending leisure time with your friends.
You know, of course we want healthy individuals, but I think particularly in the case of women, we have to be careful about the message we're sending about healthy versus body image, because that's such a big deal with women, right? I mean, we want to make sure that healthy is not being equated with necessarily being thin.
And that's really how a lot of my previous work fits into what I'm doing now, because a lot of what we were looking at stemmed from thinking about women's body image and their perceptions of themselves and how closely that's tied to their appearance. Unfortunately, that is the case for a lot of young women. How can we better understand what effect that has, and how can we differentiate physical activity from your appearance to a certain extent? So how can we make this more about an investment in your health, an investment in feeling good about yourself regardless of what you look like? You can feel accomplished because you went to the gym or you went for a walk. It clears your head. It reduces stress. All of the physical and mental benefits that really don't have anything to do with appearance, because you're absolutely right. It isn't about that. And really what we try to promote in public health, and I'm a psychologist, but a lot of my work really has public health implications. Really what we're trying to do in public health is promote the minimum or the normative of being healthy. What do we know is going to prolong your life and prolong the quality of your life? It's not about looking a certain way. It's not about conforming to some ideal. And if losing weight is something that would be healthy for you and would motivate you for over a certain period of time, that's great. But how do you keep it up even after you lose the weight, or even after you look the way you want to? And really pulling those two apart, I think, is what needs to happen a lot more, particularly for women. How do we promote physical activity for health, physical and mental health reasons, rather than just because I want it to make me look good?
I know we're talking about activity level here, but was there anything about eating?
Right. So two major points. One is that we also took people's weight. We actually weighed them, did their height and weight when they came in to answer our questions and to get the pedometers each time over 2 years. So we had that objective information. We also did a 3-day food recall so that we could calculate approximately how many calories they'd eaten at each of these assessments over 2 years. And we did not see the same patterns with BMI change and weight change, or with change in calorie intake, that we saw with perceptions of overeating and perceptions of body image. So this really is the way that you think about yourself. It's not even necessarily the reality of your behavior or responding to actual changes in your weight. What you're responding to is the way you think and feel about yourself. And I think that is really important and potentially more malleable than just talking about changing your weight or changing the amount of calories that you're eating. We really need to be focused much more on the way that women think about themselves and the way that they talk to themselves about their behaviors and about their weight. And one thing that we didn't assess, but one of the things that my research team is really invested in on our campus, is making sure that people have knowledge of what resources are available on and near campus. It's not just on campus, but how do you actually get people to explore the areas around their campus? We have a gorgeous park not even a mile from our campus that not a lot of students ever visit because they don't really know about it. So one of the ways that campuses can really promote healthy behavior beyond just going to the gym is helping students understand what are all the resources that are available and making sure that that information is available to them in ways that maybe we wouldn't ordinarily think of. So do they have to go specifically look for that information, or is it available to them pretty much in classroom buildings, in their dorms? Do their RAs know about it? Getting to them where they actually are. One other just sort of side note is that We had our participants using pedometers. So what we were collecting was their overall level of physical activity. It wasn't just going to the gym. So that was embedded in there for sure. But we were also looking at just were they going for a leisurely, slow walk that wouldn't necessarily be the same as going to the gym. And reminding especially young women that you don't have to be going to the gym 5 days a week for an hour to be healthy, that going out for a walk and just taking a break from studying every once in a while, even if you're not getting your heart rate up, that that's still really good for you.
Dr. Danielle Arrigo is assistant professor of psychology at the University of Scranton. She spoke with the Best of Our Knowledge's Allison Dunn. And this segment originally aired on Allison's program, 51%. You really should listen to that show or download the 51% podcast. Still to come, body image and other pressures aren't just for college students. That story's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Pressures on young women like body image and getting good grades don't wait until college. The pressures on high school students vary depending on their grade level and gender. Eileen Buckley from Station WBFO in Buffalo met with 8 students from Lakeshore Central High School in Angola, New York, to talk about those pressures.
4 high school teenage girls gathered at 2 round cafeteria tables discussing their school life.
I actually had a great 4 years, but I'm ready to actually leave. I'm ready for college.
Senior Leah Mosier kicked off our conversation. She's anxious to complete high school and graduate this June. But Mosier's generation has a big distraction, online living.
So it's kind of an issue because that's all you pay attention to is social media. So when you're in school, a lot of people go on Twitter, Instagram, Snapchat. It's hard to pay attention sometimes. People talk about other people on social media, so like that also affects people's lives in school, which is really hard for them, so I feel bad for that.
So it's distracting.
It's like a distraction, yeah.
Mosier tries to avoid girl drama, but says she does witness cyberbullying. She tells us too many students just say what's on their mind without thinking about hurting others' feelings. The teen finds completing schoolwork and homework, preparing for tests, and getting along with students and teachers all a major challenge for many students.
Just being able to come to school in the morning. Some people have things going on in their life that you don't know about, so when they come to school and they're in a bad mood, you can't really tell them to stop because you don't know exactly what's going on in their life.
Trying to grow up and you're trying to realize what's important, and you have to focus more on school and getting into colleges now and think about what you want to do with your life.
Lakeshore High School junior Dylan Gartley describing pressure of being a teenager.
What about behaviors and student behaviors? Does it affect you in your life?
Yeah, I feel like some people have trouble growing up, and they can definitely affect other people. And like the atmosphere being in the classroom and trying to learn while other people don't really care about that. And that goes along with like social media and stuff, how everybody's on it all the time.
There is so much social media. It's just hooked into your whole lives, isn't it?
Yeah, I feel like no matter what, everybody is part of it.
Do you see cyberbullying with each other? Have you been a victim of it?
Never personally been a victim of it, but yeah, I see it a lot, especially on like Twitter. So if everybody's doing something to somebody else.
For a second-year high school student, maintaining friendships is a major challenge. Rebecca Perry tells us balancing her social life, school life, and schedule as a student athlete has become very difficult.
Well, I don't get home until about like 5:30 every night because I run cross-country and track. And so as soon as I get home, I try to do my homework and studying everything, but a lot of times I tend to get distracted by my phone, so it's really difficult. A lot of times I don't go to bed until around midnight, so I barely get any sleep too, so.
What's happening on your phone? What are you doing? Social media?
Yeah, looking at Twitter and Instagram.
Is it to the point of you know you should just put the phone down and walk away?
Yeah, honestly, I'd say I'm not on my phone as much as my friends, but I definitely do try to take part in it because everyone like in our school does, and I feel like I'm missing out if I'm not.
I've seen a lot of times people are put down online or people's appearances are made fun of.
That's Matea Riley, a junior at Lakeshore.
I fear for their self-esteem because what bullying does to your self-esteem makes it almost like hard to recover in your life because this is such an important stage of our lives that when your self-esteem is damaged like that when you're this age, it can carry on to when you're an adult.
Do you see it as kind of a destructive factor in their life?
I see it as definitely very destructive because it's hard to figure out what you want your purpose to be professionally and otherwise when you don't really know who you are because you're too busy trying to follow trends or trying to be like someone that you're not.
Riley says she tries to stay off social media, taking breaks from her phone. This frees her up to do things she enjoys, like writing poetry, short stories, and reading.
What about time management for you? How do you deal with that as a team?
It's pretty hard to deal with time management because it's getting harder and harder to stand out to colleges because of, you know, so many other accomplishments that are occurring. And so you really have to pack your schedule and become busy so that colleges will see you as an outstanding student.
And that report comes from Eileen Buckley from station WBFO in Buffalo, New York. Are your friends and family making you feel bad about trying to be healthy? That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Are your friends keeping you overweight? I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Lindsay Romo, assistant professor in the Department of Communication at North Carolina State University, discusses how wanting to fit in at mealtime could lead to gaining back all that weight you just lost.
As if losing weight wasn't hard enough. Far too often, people end up regaining the weight they've lost, and then some, despite their best efforts to keep weight off. Through interviews of 40 people, who used to be overweight or obese, but now consider themselves thin, I found formerly heavier people sometimes face lean stigma. Lean stigma is an interpersonal barrier that can make maintaining weight loss and sustaining healthy diet and exercise habits a challenge. Lean stigma involves derogatory comments about thin people's weight management or attempts at sabotage by people who formerly knew them as larger. To counter this stigma, study participants either shared up front the mostly health reasons they wanted to lose weight to prevent others from feeling uncomfortable or judged, or participants concealed their healthier eating habits or passed as an unhealthy eater to avoid scrutiny and to assimilate with others. For instance, many participants ate smaller portions of unhealthy food that wasn't normally on their diet to give the impression they still ate like everyone else. Others accepted food but said they'd eat it later, only to throw it away when people weren't looking. Bought dessert for the table to convey they weren't anti-sweets, or saved their cheat day for a night out with friends so they could still eat and drink like old times. If participants were directly asked about their weight loss or healthier lifestyles, they made personal excuses, such as explaining they felt better this way versus proselytizing about weight management. Participants didn't want others to feel guilty or self-conscious about their own eating or exercise habits. These communication strategies helped participants fit in, made others feel more at ease and less threatened by the weight loss, and minimize the risk of lean stigma, an interpersonal challenge to successful weight loss and maintenance.
That was Lindsay Romo of North Carolina State University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. Thank you. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at @TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barron. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barron is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.